A young engineer has just finished his university training and he's going for his first job. And at the job interview, everything's going really well. There's been questions about his studies. There have been questions about things he's interested in, about his personality and his suitability for the job. And it comes to that part of the interview where the interviewer asks the young engineer, what sort of salary would you be looking at? What kind of figure would you be thinking of? And the young engineer says, around 120,000 a year. And the interviewer says, yeah, and you could have 5 weeks annual leave and special medical dental benefits. And I think the company also would throw in some extra superannuation as well. And we could even give you a car. How about a sports car? Even a red sports car. At this point, the young man's mouth is wide open and he says, wow, you've got to be kidding. And the interviewer says, well, you started it. Jesus has a lot to say about money and possessions. In fact, someone has actually gone through the Bible and calculated that there are more than 2,000 verses on money and possessions in the Bible. And that one seventh of the Bible passages from Luke are concerned with money and possessions. Jesus certainly has a lot to say about it, so it must be something that's really important. I want us to think this morning, before we look at our passage, people who are Christians, people who believe in God, have a view of money which is different to those people who aren't Christians. A Christian ceases to trust in money and to trust in God. And a Christian ceases to serve money and to serve God. You see, Jesus' way of looking at it seems to be upside down, often the opposite to the way that the world looks at it. A Christian comes to understand that these things that we have, the possessions, the money, these things that we have don't last. The best we can do with our money and possessions is to use them in a way that's going to extend God's kingdom, that's going to help other people come to know Jesus Christ. Now, this parable that we're looking at this morning, Luke chapter 16, we need to see this as one of these parables that's talking about money. It's followed soon after, at the end of chapter 16, we'll come to in a couple of weeks' time, about the parable, talking about the rich man and Lazarus. It's been described, this parable, as one of the most difficult parables in the whole Bible. In fact, Lloyd Ogilvy says, there's no parable with as many enticing dead-end possibilities as this one. And as I looked through commentaries and thought about this parable, I agree with him. There's quite a few different interpretations. And I want you this morning to put your thinking caps on and to have a look at this with me. It may be that you have a different interpretation to the one I'm going to share with you today. We note at the beginning of this chapter that Jesus here is talking to the disciples. He's teaching the disciples. As we read on in chapter 16, we come to verse 14 a bit later on, and we see that we're told the Pharisees are also listening to Jesus' teaching, and they're quite upset with what Jesus has to say in this parable. So the disciples and the Pharisees are listening. In the NIV, this is called the parable of the shrewd manager. In some other versions, it's called the parable of the unjust steward. A steward is sort of like a manager who looks after a household or an estate. In this case, one who arranges the house and property for his master. It's the one who's given responsibility to oversee the activities of the master's home and servants and his financial resources. He's to do all this for the honour of his master and for the glory of his master. So his master looks good and things are in order. So here we have the parable. We find that this so-called shrewd manager, his boss, who's a rich man, calls him into his office one day and says, what's this I hear about the way you've been handling my affairs? I hear you've been squandering my assets. This is the end of the line for you, I'm giving you notice. You're fired. Get your books in order and make an accounting of all that I've given you to manage. Now, back in those days, to squander one's resources or possessions was seen as being a shameful crime. So this guy's in hot water. This manager's in trouble. So he thinks to himself, gee, I've just lost my job. I'm too proud to beg. I don't know what to do. And it comes to him quickly. Hey, I've got an idea. At least I can offer a few favours to people while I can, so that in the future when I'm out of a job, these people will welcome me into their homes, will look after me or care for me. And back in those days, people who were very conscious of favours, and so he thought this was going to be a really good move. So he begins to approach the people who are indebted to his master. Seems like he's got a short time, maybe a few days, maybe a couple of weeks, we don't exactly know. But he thinks, I'll get in first. Maybe it's like this. Hello, Abraham? Yeah, this is Levi here. Yeah, I know the check's in the mail. Listen, I'm not calling to collect. I'm calling to offer you a deal. In fact, I've always liked you. Here's what I'm going to do. You see, you owe my boss 800 barrels of oil, right? That's what it shows here. I've got it written down here, 800. Now, what would you think if I lowered that down to, say, 400? Yeah, I thought you'd like that. No strings attached. Just leave the boss to me. I'll write it down in my record, just like I'm doing now. You write it down too. Hey, oh, you're very welcome. Yeah, look, I'm glad to help out a friend. Yeah, I'm sure I'll see you around, okay? Yeah, right. Okay, cheers. I mean, shalom. He hangs up and he does the same thing to the next guy who owes the bushels of wheat and so on until he's dealt with all the debtors in the same way. 2 weeks later, this guy I've called Levi comes to his boss and opens up the books. What do you expect to happen? Well, you'd expect the boss to blow his top. I mean, not only has this manager been incompetent, he's dishonest. But instead, what does his master say? His master, we find, praises him. And he says, words to the effect, I've got to hand it to you. You made some shrewd moves here. Not bad. Not bad at all. As we look at this, we see this shrewd manager, his mindset is, well, I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. I'll look after you and you'll look after me. It's possible here that the ex-manager is removing his commission and charging the debtors wholesale. Some of the commentators point out that this was a fairly common practice. Since the Jews couldn't charge interest, they'd overcharge to compensate for the interest they would have made. Whether this is true or not is beside the point. The master here is not commending the servant for his dishonesty, but because he wisely prepared for his future. And the ex-manager now had some standing with these people that he now classes as friends who will welcome him. Before we come to this master's response, this rich man's response to being ripped off by his servant, or Jesus' commentary on this parable, I want us to take note this morning of the character of this manager, this steward, this man who is to look after the rich man's affairs. Both at the beginning of this parable and at the end of this parable, we see that this man was a crook. He was an unholy person. He was unfaithful as a servant. He was unfaithful to his task and to his master. That was his job. His job was to look after his master's affair and to do it properly. And this unfaithfulness is what necessitated his shrewdness in preparing for his future. Every indication points to the fact that the allegations against the manager, that is, squandering his possessions, were accurate. The manager didn't change for the good. He only became more shrewd in doing evil. The manager's attitudes and actions were all motivated by self-interest, and it seems like he involved others in his scam as well. it's possible that these rich man's debtors were co-conspirators with him. In other words, they knew what was going on and what they were doing. And the manager just appealed to their greed. Now, in telling this parable, Jesus didn't minimize the wrong that this man did, nor did he in any way commend him for doing evil. But his master did commend him. So probably the biggest surprise in this parable is that the master, who's just been diddled or ripped off by his manager, is able to praise him. And this praise is not for the good that he's done his master, nor for the ethical aspects of his deed, but simply for the shrewdness with which he displayed. And so I think the critical question here is, why can this man, this master, who's just been exploited by his employee, a man who suffered substantial loss, commend a crooked employee? And the answer to this question is given by Jesus in the second half of verse 8. And I believe it's the key to the interpretation of this passage. Let me read verse 8 again to you. The master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. And then we go on to Jesus' interpretation, which is indicated by the word for. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind, literally their own generation, than are the people of the light. So is Jesus here praising dishonesty? I think here Jesus' words indicate several important realities. It suggests, I think, that the shrewd manager and his master appreciated or valued the same thing, shrewdness. I mean, you don't commend a man for something you disdain. And both the manager and his masters were members of the group which Jesus has characterized as the people of this world or this age. The contemporary expression was, or could be, it takes one to know one. Maybe the master could recognize and appreciate shrewdness because it was something he valued himself and practiced himself. And it, as one, he was one with the steward or the manager in this kind of attitude. We also note here that the characters in this story, the rich man and the manager, weren't identified as Jesus as being people of the light or believers. Perhaps we could say then that the master commended his manager's shrewdness because he knew that he would have done the same thing in the same circumstances. You don't praise what you would not do or wish you could have done or thought what was a smart move. So we come back to the question, is Jesus praising dishonesty? Well, I don't think so. I think the answer, and my opinion, is that even though some commentators accept that the parable here is teaching that we're meant to be smart, like people of the world, in the way that we handle money and possessions, I don't think Jesus here is commending shrewdness. The word shrewd or shrewdly is found twice in this parable in verse 8, but Jesus never implies or uses that particular word. In fact, the concept that's most frequently found in Jesus' interpretation and application is the word faithfulness or trust. Faithfulness and shrewdness, I think, in this text are diametrically opposed. The steward had to be shrewd because he had been unfaithful. And disciples are to be faithful, not we don't need to be shrewd. We find in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, in chapter 3, verse 1, that shrewdness characterizes Satan. The serpent was more crafty than any other wild animal. But I don't think this should characterize a Christian. We're to be as wise as serpents and as harmless as dove, we read in Matthew 10:16. I'll come back to this a little bit later. I think Jesus told us this parable and said here, instead of both of these men are typical of the values and conduct of an unbelieving generation. In other words, here's an example of the way the world acts. Don't be like that. He's not saying to us to imitate it or commend it to us. We find in the book of Proverbs, a number of Proverbs which tell us the way life is and says, have a look at this. This is the way life is. It doesn't mean that we should be like that, but rather we should avoid it. For example, Proverbs 10:15 says, "The rich man's wealth is his fortress. The ruin of the poor is their poverty." And in 17:8 we read, "A bribe is a charm in the sight of its owner. Wherever he turns, he prospers." In each of these cases, life is being described as it is, not as it should be. So it is in this parable. Jesus is telling a story which describes the skill which unbelievers have at working within their generation to make money and to look out for themselves. In all other areas of Christian living, God's blessing in the area of finances is not based on men or women's skill or shrewdness, but on their faithfulness to his promises. So our responsibility, I believe, here is in the area of faithfulness, which Jesus commended, which not shrewdness, which Jesus characterized as typical of unbelievers. As we read on in this chapter, we come to verse 15, which is not part of our reading today, but we note here that Jesus says that the things which are highly esteemed by men are detestable to God. It tells us that God's values contradict man's. What God condemns, he does not commend. Now let me come back to that Matthew chapter 10, verse 16 again. "Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves." It all comes down, I think, to what we understand by the word shrewd. And the Amplified Bible here adds to after the word shrewd, "wary and wise. Therefore be wary and wise as serpents and innocent as doves." We find sometimes in the Bible that particular words in Greek and Hebrew, sometimes the same term doesn't always convey the same meaning. An example of this would be the word tempt, which is also rendered as test. We know that God does not tempt anyone, in James 1:12, but we also know that he does test, and we're told to test ourselves in 2 Corinthians 13:5. So I went to the dictionary and looked up shrewd and found that it has a number of different meanings. One meaning is that it means we're characterized by keen awareness, sharp intelligence, and a sense of the practical. Another meaning is disposed to artful and cunning practices and tricky. And it comes from a root from the word shrewd, which means wicked. So it can mean different things. It can either have a positive or a negative meaning to it. Matthew seems to use the term in a positive way when he uses shrewd, meaning wary and wise, whereas Paul in the New Testament uses it sometimes in a negative vein, meaning arrogantly wise or falsely wise. And I believe in this passage the word shrewd is used in the negative rather than the positive way. I mean, if wisdom were the ideal to strive for, I think Jesus wouldn't have made the model a crook, nor would he have made his master commend him. I don't know who handles the finances in your family, whether you're the finance person. Now, I'm very blessed because my wife worked for an accountant for 15 years, has run her own business along with Ruth for the last 5 or so years, and is very canny, shrewd with money. And something happened this week. We got an account from the bank that showed that some money that should have been there wasn't there. So my wife was onto it straight away. What's happened here? And tries to track down, looking through, finding out what had gone wrong, to find out that some money that was meant to be transferred hadn't been transferred over to be in the account. She's a good manager of money, and I'm a bit the opposite in that I'm not really aware of what's going on most of the time, as long as I've got my money to buy my newspaper each day. That's about the extent of it. But I think there's some warnings here and some recommendations from us from Jesus to be careful in the way that we use our money and possessions. And I want to go on just to look at the next few verses here. Verse 9 particularly is the one that causes some concern amongst the commentators in its interpretation. Let me read it to you. "I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you'll be welcomed into eternal dwellings." Now, on the surface, this looks like using the money that we've got to buy friends. That's what the manager in our story this morning in the parable did, didn't he? He used the boss's money, really, to make sure that he had a place to go when he was put out of work. I think what this verse is saying is the money that we've been given and the possessions that we've got, the wealth that we've got, is to gain friends in the sense of evangelizing. In other words, bringing people to know Jesus and extending his kingdom. So that when our money's gone, and it will go, money won't last forever, that money will have been used to bring people to know Jesus into eternal dwellings. In other words, we'll be welcomed by those people who've come to faith. So I believe there's an impetus there, an importance for us to underline this morning. Are we using our money, our wealth, to make friends in the sense of bringing people to know Jesus? Have a think about your own life. If you're a believer, if you're a Christian here this morning, how have you used your money to help other people know Jesus? I went to visit my stepmum, who is in hospital and then in a nursing home. She'd wanted to stay in her own home, even though she was struggling with ill health. She had care people coming to her home, helping her, nursing her. But she was determined she was going to stay and have her 90th birthday in her own home, which she did. And soon after, sadly, she had a fall and hurt her hip and ended up in hospital and then nursing care in a nursing home. When I went to visit her near the end, when she was declining in health, I looked around the room and there was her bed. She had a few items in her drawers of clothing. But her only real possession, the thing that she had, was a radio, a little transistor radio. And I said, is there other things that you need, that you want? And she had a lovely house, just a modest house with things that she collected over her 90 years. And all she wanted was family, friends, and she could listen to her radio. And this is something that spoke really powerfully to me, because I thought, in the end, what do we take with us? What's important? Family, friends, and particularly those who are going to be with us eternally. Jesus, in verses 10 to 13, goes on to give some principles. He says, whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? In other words, we start with a little. If we're faithful with the little that we have, we can be trusted with more. And I wonder, what's the little that you have? You might say, well, I don't have much money. But all of us have something. How do we use that we've been given to God's glory? Whoever can be trusted. So the thing I think we can learn here is, how are we faithful to God in the use of our money? If we're faithful, then we'll be trusted with true riches, which I take to mean riches being eternal life and in union with Jesus Christ. No servant can serve two masters, verse 13. Either he will hate one and love the other, or he'll be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. Now that's really a dividing line, isn't it? It's not saying there's some lines of grey, but can't I keep my boat, and aren't these other things more important? Aren't there areas of my life that I can sort of keep just to myself and keep God out of it? You cannot serve both God and money. And here I believe it's talking about our sacrifice. It's saying, what are we prepared to lay down to serve God? And that there's really one choice. It's either God or it's money. You can't have both, because if you do, you'll be pulled apart. You'll either love one, you'll hate the other. You can't love both. You'll have a divided interest. That's a challenge for us today. Who are you serving? Is it God? Is it money? Who's the most important? If you choose God, then how do you make those decisions about the things that you're buying, the way that you're using your money? Well, let me tell you that Jesus sometimes was looked at as being foolish. These Pharisees who were listening looked down their nose at Jesus and sneered at him, we read in verse 14, because they loved money. In other words, they said that they love God, but obviously their love of money and the status that it bought and the power that it bought was something that was more important to them. I ask myself, how am I like one of those Pharisees? That's the dividing line. No wonder they were upset with Jesus, who owned nothing and was poor. If you're going to love God and put God above the use of the resources that God has given you and use them in a godly way, then people will think you as foolish. They won't understand when you give money to a building fund for a church necessarily. They won't understand when you support someone doing theological study. They won't understand when you give money to the poor necessarily. They won't necessarily understand in the way that you organise your finances, because it doesn't seem to be the way that makes sense or is shrewd in the way that the world understands it. You see, that's the way it is. That's the choice that you have to make. Is it God or is it money?